This is Fam Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Dr. Fred. How you doing today, this
I'm doing
morning?
good. Thanks for having me here. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Well, it's great to talk to people from all over the world, and it's the first time we're talking to you, and we're going to be talking about, you're a mental health advocate and psychiatrist, and we're going to talk about unmasking mental health beyond diagnosis. That's the topic that we want to talk about today. And we've also got your link up there is Dr. I just had it, drfred360.com. That'll be fully clickable for everybody who's watching or listening. You'll be able to click through on that and on any of the podcast platforms that we're on. So I wanted to begin with a question I always ask all the guests that show up. There's two questions I always ask everybody. What motivates you and why do you do what you do?
Well, I think I was born a healer. And so I get very excited. I get riveted when I can help anybody move their life forward. And any way that I can be with another person and actually help them optimize their life and find direction or give them purpose or some kind of compelling vision, I am always in. I have been in for that task since the day I arrived on this planet. As I, was born into a family of two parents and a couple teenage boys. And so they were already in a fair amount of chaos and disarray, as they tell me. And my job was to come there and bring joy and love and peace to a family in chaos and disarray. And I've just been doing that ever since.
That's good that you knew your purpose from the beginning. That's always good to know because sometimes people are struggling to figure out what they're going to do.
Well, don't get me
One of
wrong.
the
It definitely
topics,
has
what
been.
questions that you like to answer that we're going to go ahead.
I'm saying it's not like it's been a straight shot. It
Go.
isn't like I've known this for 66 years every single day. But when I look back and answer that question, that's what comes to mind.
Comes to mind. Okay. So one of the things that we want to get into this concept of how can someone undoctor their mental illness, and maybe you can define what undoctor means for you.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what the undoctor is. The undoctor is a name, it's a moniker that I received a few years ago from a good friend when he heard me again. And I was at a retreat with him and a bunch of other men. And talking a little bit about what my task is in life as a psychiatrist. So I've been a psychiatrist for 35 years, and I've been in the mental health field for 44 years, ever since January of 1980. And I went into that field in January of 1980, after dropping out of college for the second time. And I made it clear to my mom and my dad that I would never go back to university under any conditions. So, of course, my mom wanted me to get a job because that's what moms do, right? Get a job. All right, mom. So she got me an application as a childcare worker at a state mental health facility for adolescent boys. And for the first time in my life, I was doing what I really loved doing and getting paid for it. And that was actually having great conversations with people. These people were these so-called kids, 6 or 7 years younger than me, who were having some form of trouble or had found themselves in a state hospital one way or another. But after all, so did I. I just happened to be on the staff side. And there I was. And we were just having great conversations and healing was taking place. And I knew in my heart of hearts, all the way back from that first day when I already told you I was born, that communication was where it was all at. That was what I was enchanted with. That was what was in so engaging and compelling for me looking forward. I always wanted to learn how to communicate. And here I was learning not only how to speak effectively, but how to listen. I was finally realizing that communication could heal. These kids were healing and all that. And, I was healing in their presence. The thing I really disliked about that job, as it turns out, was psychiatry. I really, really disliked psychiatry. I thought it was headed in the wrong direction. Jimmy and Johnny would get into a fight and or Timmy would be up too late. And then we'd call the doctor on call and he'd come running down or walking fast anyways and show up and talk to Timmy for like 3 seconds and then talk to us for like 7 seconds and then go into the nursing station. Take out that weapon called a pen and write it into a chart. And then we'd have to go retrieve Timmy and hold him down in the quiet room while we jammed him full of some antipsychotic, anti-anxiety cocktail injection. And if he was in a stupor for like 24 hours,
Well, that
success.
was that's the success is just to kind of just medicate and just kind of put people into to sleep or just get them nodding off or not to be trouble. I guess is that the general problem with mental health in the U.S.?
Well, I think we'll get to that in just a moment. I think it's a great question. I love how you posed it, and it's I'll get right to it. But here, let me just get to a little bit more history, and we can come right back to that. It's because what ends up happening is I, as I just stated, really realized that communication was how people heal, and that the medications, you know, at that time, Prozac wasn't even invented yet. When Prozac got invented, that was, I went back to medical school. I went back to finish my degree and then go to medical school so that I could bring a so that I could be a psychiatrist and bring communication forward. That was my whole purpose. But while I was in medical school, Prozac was invented and released. And that changed the world like none of the people your age could even know. I mean, Prozac was the pill, the green and white capsule, was on the cover of Newsweek all by itself. It was on the cover of Time the next week all by itself, because it was there to alter, you know, to have us all believe that if we were uncomfortable in any way, shape, or form, that was our problem and that it could be fixed with a pill. That totally changed everything on how people were thought of the world. And since that time, it's still very much what's part of the American mental health system. If you're uncomfortable in any way, shape, or form, depressed, scared, sad, frightened, nervous, maybe aimless or confused or scattered, if you're uncomfortable in any way, you come running to a psychiatrist and tell them there's something wrong with you, and they will find a pill to give you. And typically that pill doesn't make things that much better. It actually typically makes things worse. And the way it makes things worse, it often perpetuates the symptoms it's marketed to treat, or else creates another set of symptoms that forces you to take medicines from another class.
Yeah. Another pill for the other pill. It's like keep on taking cascading levels of medication.
Yeah, this is a fantastic business model, by the way. I can't, you know, can't put down the business model. It's fantastic.
Pharmaceutical companies, like stock price goes up.
Exactly, man. You know, and look, you're looking at billions of dollars per day in profit margin. There literally has never in the history of the planet been an industry that had billions of dollars a day in profit margin before this industry, ever.
That's sad, because like you said, you know, you start with communication, and I think it's maybe that's uncomfortable. What I find, you know, being an artist, your vulnerability is a thing that a lot of artists, you know, we tap into.
Right.
A lot of people are scared of being vulnerable. And so they'll put layers and layers of all kind of artifice and maybe medications to kind of tamp that down because it's too scary.
Exactly.
So is that kind of where you work?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the actual creativity is kind of muffled, you know, is stifled in that situation. And, you know, we can remove sort of depression if you allow us to move everything. We can stop you from having depression if you agree to not have anything, not have hunger, not have lust, not have friends,
any interaction.
Yeah, we could do that, you know. And so the medications, you know, look, it's not like the medications themselves are evil. That's like saying rat poison is evil. It isn't evil. It's just a thing.
Yeah.
They're not even live. I mean, these pills, they don't make any decisions for us. So I started really looking over the next several years as I became a psychiatrist, you know, and I became very, very good as a psychopharmacologist. I'm very aware of all the psychiatric medicines. I know their doses. I know their, you know, their routes of action. I know how to deliver. I know what their drug-drug interaction profile is. I know the side effects supposedly that each of them has. I've gotten really good at that. I was typecast. When I come out of medical school and come out of residency, you know, if I was to ask you what's the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist, there'd be likely only one thing you would come up with, because that's what everybody says. Psychiatrists, what?
Is it that you can prescribe
medicine? Exactly. That's what people say. That's it. That's the only thing that people know is the difference, even though it's two entirely different set of school sets and trainings. But there I was being typecast into doing that which I really dislike doing. And halfway through my career, so it was like 2006, so I was already in, had been in practice in, I'd say, like 15 years, I decided to do something radical, which was to take people off of medicine in my practice. I had several thousand people who were in my outpatient practice, and I took some of the lower risk patients right off their medicine after discussing it with them. And sure enough, they got better and reliably way better. And in many cases, the diagnosis that they thought they had prior to taking the medicine disappeared entirely. And this happened frequently enough. And then it really cemented the idea that maybe these medicines are actually causing the symptoms they're marketed to treat.
Yeah.
Like, that's brilliant. Yes. And it'll rock the world. When I became aware of that, I really wanted to go to the mountaintops and scream it to everybody, you know, like,
you get a lot of resistance in the people in your field. I mean, I don't know what the structure is. Like, if you come out, is there like an incentive structure or a punishment structure if you don't follow that path?
It's not like it's a formalized incentive or punishment structure. It's there to some degree. I mean, once you veer away from the status quo, once you veer away from Main Street, you got to pay the price of being off target. You got to pay the price of being a little bit, you know, off center. But it's not a big price to pay. I mean, really, when you think about it, all I was saying was that people do better off of medicine than on medicine. I still get it. I mean, people are troubled. Have you noticed that it's a troubling world out there? It's a very challenging world. There's a lot of obstacles. There's a lot of hurdles. There's a lot of reasons to be afraid. There's a lot of reasons to be sad. There's a lot of reasons to be anxious. There's a lot of reasons to be scattered. If you want to ask me, can I find a reason to be any of those things anytime? It'll take me 1 second to find loads of reasons to be afraid, anxious, depressed, regretful, resentful, angry, all of those things. I can
get life.
There.
Well, it's life. I mean, life is, you know, it's not going to be ideal. Well, people want it to be idealized, and maybe that's why they want to get medicated, because it's not matching their idealized.
That's marketing. Vision. That's the marketing of the drug. It's not what the drug does. As you see, you don't know a lot of people that are taking a bunch of medicines and they're really, really happy. That's not the case.
Yeah, it's usually not the case.
You know,
yeah.
Okay, so I began to really realize that. And, you know, I began to take more and more patients off of medicine. And, you know, with really good results. It's interesting. There is a subset of people who come off medicine and it actually is, they want to come back on medicine. But that's mostly because their family and their system is used to them being sick.
Mm-hmm.
And if they get well, they become a threat to the system.
It doesn't work for that social group.
They start talking the truth. It's like, whoa.
Nobody wants to hear it.
I don't want to hear that, dude. Like, you're going back under.
Yeah.
And so that happens a lot. And, you know, I don't want to make a disclaimer because I know that we're streaming and there might be people listening right now. And I hope there is. For the people who are really into their diagnosis, who really believe that their diagnosis is what saved their lives, and then they get therapy, and then they got medicine, and they're all down with it. They think it's the greatest. They couldn't imagine a life better than they have right now on whatever medications and whatever treatment with whatever diagnosis they have. Please, please, please don't change course based on what I said.
Mm-hmm.
You stay right where you are. If you have figured out some part of life that you're happy with, that has left you empowered and you feel like it's the best it could be, dude, congratulations. Please stay on that path. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of arguing with what I'm saying. Keep doing what you're doing.
But kind of individual, like individual case by sure. Case, right? It's like a case, like everybody wants one size fits all. I think that's always a problem. What
I've
found
a problem.
That individuals, you know, have different needs and
exactly.
Different situations. And it like you said, listening skills is probably like the biggest thing you have to get into. Cause if somebody just like one, you said at the first, like 5 seconds, 7 seconds, 10 seconds, they immediately heard something and then they just did like a routine process.
Yeah.
And didn't really take the deep dive that you're talking about. Well, that takes work. that takes time.
So I guess it takes work. It takes work to eat toxic medicine too. Don't get me wrong. You know, your body has to work hard for these things that it wasn't built to manage. So look, I'm not speaking to the group that's doing very well. They can keep listening, no problem, but I'm not telling them to get off their horse. This conversation is for the hundreds of millions of people who know they're on the wrong horse.
Yeah.
And there are hundreds of millions of people who know that they're on the wrong horse. They already know. They're being misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed, overdiagnosed, overmedicated, undermedicated, unmedicated, whatever they think they are. This is that conversation. Okay. So we move on. I start doing practice. My practice shrinks in around 2006, 7, and 8 because I start taking people off medicine. They start getting better and they say goodbye. And I work myself out of a job. It's great news. Like, how cool is it to be a psychiatrist who can work himself out of a job? It was so cool. People are getting better and they said goodbye, hugs and kisses, and out the door they went. Now, I started doing some traveling work all over the United States. Locum tenens work, you know, filling in for other doctors who were sick or going to die or got fired or something. And I really learned a lot about how psychiatry was delivered all over the United States. And it was all very similar in most cases. Then I started doing work around the world. And I started doing work from Asia, from Bhutan and Thailand and Nepal and then Israel and then Italy, France, England. I started doing some work in an international level. And I started seeing really what is humanity. What's the point in this humanity thing? I don't have the answer. If y'all waiting on bated breath about what is humanity and what are they here for, I don't really know. But one thing we're here for, at least it seems very clear, is to create robust human connections. Everywhere I went, that was emphasized and amplified, no matter whether I was in, you know, like in the Tibetan neighborhoods or whether I was in Tel Aviv or whether I was in Rome or whether I was in Des Moines. They're all the same. Everyone knows there's a massive power in creating a conversation-based human connection. Everyone knows that. That's what you and I are doing after all. That's what the listeners are doing after. Why are they tuned in?
Yeah.
Because they're interested in robust, honest to goodness, core level human connection. That's what's the most important. Once that is created, massive healing happens instantaneously, by the way. Have you ever gotten to the point where you were feeling confused or in disarray or in some degree of chaos with yourself or discomfort and you spoke to it to somebody? And they got it and boom.
Yeah.
Like boom right then.
Like where you can tell your story. If you can tell your story and then somebody empathizes with you and somebody understands it and doesn't like, you know, make derogatory statements about what is going on.
Right.
Then you feel like you've been like validated.
Exactly. It's a resonating harmony. It's beauty. It's called health. It's called healing. It's called love. It's called human connection. I know that. And so do you. And so do they. And so does she. And so does he. We all know that. In our heart of hearts, we all know that that's true. Now, some of us, you might say, oh, some people, they don't like human connection. The only reason they don't like human connection is because they've been hurt so many times trying to get that which they wanted, which was a human connection. They've been hurt and they've decided it's not worth it to get so hurt pursuing a human connection. Mm-hmm. But humans are built to have and try and be with other humans. So if we look at this robustly, we start realizing that I've never seen, nor will there ever be a medication that is more healing than a human connection. Like the best medicine that's out there is a human connection. It's way better than Zoloft or Prozac or Seroquel or Adderall or whatever you think you're taking. Way better than all of those is a human connection. Now, when we start looking at that, we start saying, okay, what's the problem with these medicines? Now, you have to let me back you up to 2006 when I finally made this realization. I wanted to go to the mountaintops and tell people to come off medicine as if medicines were the problem. But it turns out that medicines aren't the problem. I don't have any entryway just being violent about telling people that medicines suck. That doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
People believe whatever they believe. And they're like, yeah, Fred, what the hell else are we supposed to do then? Here's the deal. I started realizing it's not the medicines. It's that people think there's something wrong with them.
Oh, yeah. That's the core.
That's the problem, right? And that's powerful. Because I think there's something wrong with me often too. And frankly, so do you. It's like inherently normal to think there's something wrong with you. You don't like the way you look. You don't like the way you talk. You don't like the way you think. You don't like their actions. You don't like your mistakes. You don't like your neighborhood. You don't like your life. You don't like your purpose. You're not aligned with yourself, whatever the deal is. And then you think there's something wrong with you because you compare your insides with everybody else's outsides. And you're pretty sure they got it together way more than you do. And then you start thinking there's something wrong with you. And then you go knocking on the psychiatrist door. So, and then when a psychiatrist who's listening for buzzwords, he's listening for words like he or she, whatever. And I don't mean to say whatever, but you get, I'm talking just in general, are listening for like, you know, racing thoughts. I'm scattered. I'm sad more days than not. I have, you know, I'm impulsive or I'm unable to finish tasks or I'm awkward in social situations or I have a memory that I can't shake or whatever they say. Psychiatrists are all about those buzzwords. They hear those buzzwords, they are on it like flies, dude. They are on it. And they are ready to deliver the next treatment because that's what you came to them for. As you and I used to know before we had developed our new hairstyle, if you go to a barber shop enough times, you're going to get a haircut.
Yeah.
If you go to a psychiatrist enough times, you will get medicated.
Yeah.
And here's the deal. We have to medicate you. We have to. We definitely have to diagnose you. Because in all third-party cases, no one pays for a well patient. If you come and see me and as a psychiatrist and I say nothing's wrong with you, I will not get paid. I will not get paid, my friend.
Incentive structure. They got a whole like structure to the business.
Yeah, I won't get paid. I'm not kidding. I need to give you some diagnosis. And once you have that, it's luggage. It's like gum on your shoe. You got that thing. You now have that diagnosis. Now, no problem. So everybody who's ever gone to a psychiatrist for the most part has a diagnosis. Okay, that's great. What are we going to do then? Well, people are like, well, I just need help. I need help for my depression, my anxiety, my scatteredness, that I can't finish tasks, that I'm awkward in social situations, that I have a memory I can't shake, that I'm disorganized, that I'm angry, that I'm hurting people, that I can't slow down my addiction, whatever it is. And so I came to a psychiatrist. I just need help. I'm okay with the diagnosis. That's what's wrong with me. There we get some real value. There is, honest to goodness, very real value in obtaining a diagnosis. It's very real. Because then I can say stuff like, that wasn't me. That was my diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I yell at my wife again? Because I got blah, blah, blah. Why did I turn in my paper late? Because I got blah, blah, blah. Why did I have trouble sleeping last night? It's not me. It's because I got blah, blah, blah. I got some alphabet soup. It's usually all this stuff is in acronyms, you know? PTSD or ADD or MD or what, BAD or BPD or whatever you think you might have. NPD is a good one recently, or the autistic spectrum. You know, there's so many things. There's so many diagnoses. So again, how did the UnDoctor really get its roots is I started realizing that if people would start getting together that, like you already said, out loud, emphasizing and underlined, amplified, that's life. That's life, y'all. That's it. It comes with this shit. No kidding. It comes with this shit. That's part of it. I'm sorry that you don't like it. I don't like it either. It's not a matter of liking it. No one said you're going to like it. Not liking something comes with this shit. feeling uncomfortable, in disarray, feeling disappointed or distressed or detracted or distracted or depressed, it comes with this shit. When we start realizing that there might be nothing wrong with us, you know, look, do we blame a log for burning in a fire? No. It's what a log does in a fire. Is there enough reasons to be sad, scared, and anxious in our present world? You tell me. If you're walking around thinking that not being sad, not being scared, not being anxious, not being confused in this world is what your goal is, you are in the wrong world.
Yeah. It's you're how you manage. Yes.
You're not putting this together anytime soon.
Yeah, but it seems like, you know, it's how you manage it. Like being an artist, what I've always done, and when I've talked to people, you know, in the creative community, it is the, you know, the art therapy of the cathartic nature of being a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
Or being a musician or a painter or actor is that you take those painful moments and you turn it into artistic expression.
Transmuted alchemy. Kinda, exactly.
You kind of push it, you know, you work through it and then it becomes the art.
Exactly.
And then you might, you know, those feelings might happen again. It's not that they're going to go away. You found a way to manage it.
Yeah.
And not that there's not going to be a wave, up and down wave in life. It's like, yeah, there is.
Yeah,
there's
there is.
There's going to be melancholy. There's going to be anxiousness. Exactly. There's going to be anger. But exactly. I work through that. And I find a way to work through it. I see people who don't have artistic tendencies. They don't know how to work through it. And then they want the pill.
Exactly. You said so much there. So if you look at some of the artists, you know, some of the more famous or prolific artists of all time, if you think Salvador Dali had it together, he did. He was amazing. I love the dude. He's like the best. He's my favorite of all time. I love the guy completely. Or Pablo. If you look at Gauguin, if you look at Monet, if you look at Matisse, if you look at Rodin, you know, again, these are people, and Michelangelo, if you look at all these folks, they had some shit going on in their head for sure. This was a hard life that they were living. And this was just a way to express it and transmute it, and alchemize it into what turned out to be beautiful artistic self-expression. Now, when we start looking that there might be nothing wrong with you, then you don't have to go to a psychiatrist to fix you. Right? If there's nothing wrong with you, there's nothing to fix. And then you won't need to be thinking that swallowing something made in a laboratory is going to help you get a better life. Mm-hmm. Because that's the fallacy. And all I'm really doing right there is giving the power back to you. It's not the pills, right? It's not the medical industry. It's not even your doctor. It's definitely not the insurance company. It's not your parents. It's not your kids. It's not the Republicans or the Democrats. It's not any of that. This is a decision that you're making that there's something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. And when you make that decision, you then confirm that you think you need to be fixed. And then you go to a doctor, the barbershop, and he says, yeah, I got something for you. I got an app for that. And boom, you get a prescription. And now you're taking a prescription, which in fact, oftentimes creates the symptoms it's marketed to treat. Okay, so now you're depressed because you take antidepressants. You're anxious because you take benzodiazepines. You're psychotic because you take antipsychotics. You're like, oh yeah. These make me better because instantly they have a tendency to have you think they made you better. All right. And you know, instead, that's how you can see how the undoctor starts to unfold out of here. Pretty soon I start realizing that in order for people to get better, the first thing we're going to have to do is undiagnose them. We're going to have to let them know, hey, dude, welcome to humanity.
So I guess my question is, like, when you realize that, you said you kind of got yourself out of a job, but you're like, if you're as a doctor, you need to have a job. So how did you navigate that to be, you know, something where you could still make a living and then help people?
Yeah, great question. So here's what I ended up doing. I've quit medicine four separate times in my life, and twice on half a, you know, no day's notice, like today, like take this job and shove it. Like it's, we're done. Two times I gave notice, two times no notice. I just couldn't do it another minute. And so, you know, fortunately, there was this thing called life coaching that was getting to be bigger and bigger and bigger. So I began to be a life coach, an entrepreneur, a transformational coach, a restorative coach, one who helps people who think there might be something wrong with them when there really isn't, or who feel stuck when they're really not. And through powerful conversation, right? Robust human connection, I can walk people into a life that actually works. Like, no kidding. Like actually using some of the things that I have in the list of like what's called the Moss method, where we start looking at, you know, meditation, and we start looking at Tai Chi and Qigong. We start looking at nature walks and journaling and reading real books and sleep hygiene and spirituality and being of service and creativity, art, music, dancing, singing, drama, cooking, writing, gardening, these kinds of things. I wrote a book about that. My book is called The Creative Eight, and it's about that. And How to Find Your True Voice, that's my other book. Like actually having authentic conversations from your core self. Now, when that's the case, when I start pushing that forward, for a while there, I couldn't do it as a psychiatrist, you know, because we've already decided what a psychiatrist is for.
Yeah.
Diagnosis and medicine. That's what it is. That's it. So what did I do? I tried to interface. I tried to be like, okay, yeah, you came to me because you want a diagnosis and you want medicine, but I'm not entirely aligned that there's something wrong with you. Do you want to know something that's really interesting? Psychiatry is the only subspecialty in all of medicine that if you tell someone there's nothing wrong with them, they get pissed.
Because they were looking for that diagnosis.
Go to an oncologist, and when they tell you that there's nothing wrong with you, you're going to be thrilled.
You're thrilled, yeah.
How about cardiologists? Same thing. How about ophthalmologists? Same thing. How about, you know, proctologists? Same thing. How about anything?
Yeah.
But you go to a psychiatrist and they tell you there's nothing wrong with you, you're like, dude, I'm going next door to find a real doc.
Yeah, it's a conundrum. Yeah. So how do you get... So the life coaching model, you found a way to like, okay, well, in this model... I can do no harm with the, like, I don't want to be in that other place.
Exactly.
Where I see you don't see it working. So he's like, if you don't feel what you're doing is having an effect, you probably, you know, you don't want to be there.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that happened a bunch of times. And you mentioned the do no harm. So that was a key feature of this whole thing, is that how can I do this without doing harm? And it's a constant struggle. I want to say that, you know, because if just because I don't want to deliver medicines and a diagnosis doesn't mean that I'm doing no harm. In other words, if I leave these people be, they're just going to go next door and get it anyways. Mm-hmm. Was that the best thing that I could do? It's a big question here. You know, can I engage somebody and have them just start realizing that maybe there's an adjustment they can make that's different than what they thought they needed? So can I meet people where they're at and open up new conversations to the possibility that maybe they don't deserve a diagnosis and medication? Maybe they just deserve to be heard.
Yeah, you're thinking out the box. Like, and everybody's always in the box. And like, you're undoctoring is kind of like, I've always talked about this unconventional, out of the box thinking, because everybody wants to, you know, clone the next thing or copy things or just be on a, you know, just be on an autopilot. You just plug it in. You know, you say, okay, I just want to be on this routine. And that's not always what's necessary.
No, not only is it not necessary, it makes things worse, my friend. Let's keep this in mind. If it was just a Band-Aid, I'm in. I'm good with a Band-Aid. I don't mind Band-Aids. Band-Aid, it's fine. When I get a cut, I don't want to bleed on my bed sheets. I put on a Band-Aid. But it's not a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid with a razor blade embedded in it. Mm-hmm. Which you can see how that would work. If I put a big band, let's say I cut my thigh and I put on a big Band-Aid for a while there, even if it has a razor blade in it, it'll look like it's working.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The blood will stop. And then moments later or days later, it'll start oozing out of the sides. And I'll think that my cut got worse. So the only thing I can do in that situation that I think is to get a bigger Band-Aid.
Yep.
And that's what happens in psychiatry with the medications. We get more, we get add, change, or increase of medicines. People come in, they very rarely do they say, it's every so often, for goodness sake, for sure. Very rarely do they say, I want to decrease my medicine or I want to come off my medicine for real. It's very rare. And doctors don't even know how to take people off of medicine. We're not taught that in medical school. In fact, doctors don't even know how to talk to patients anymore. There's no more psychotherapy in residency in psychiatry at all.
Wow.
They just don't teach it because we don't need to talk to you. Why waste time doing that?
Wasn't that the original concept was the talking, though?
Of course. Yeah, Sigmund Freud didn't have any kind of medication. CG did not have any kind of medications. That's right. That's what the whole point was initially. If you look at the founding fathers of what psychiatry was about, if you start with Freud anyways, they come from before that, of course, the philosophers and, you know, Kierkegaard and all them, the ontologicals. But when you start looking at these group of people, of course it was meant to be conversations. That's what psychoanalysis was. That's, you know, when you start looking at Carl Rogers and Irving Yalom, the people who have made a difference in this field through conversation. But these days, psychiatry isn't about that. If you want conversations, go to another subprofessional.
Wow.
Not from psychiatry. Psychiatry is where you go when conversations don't work, supposedly.
Oh, okay. That's where it's become today.
That's what it's come today is that, you know, if you're a psychologist and you have a patient and conversations haven't worked to get them better, you finally just punt. Okay, you're going to a psychiatrist so we can change you fundamentally. Because obviously conversations with me aren't working to get you better. So therefore, psychology doesn't work. Social work doesn't work. Counseling doesn't work. Therapy doesn't work. You know, couples counseling doesn't work. Group counseling doesn't work because that's what I do. And you didn't get better. And since you didn't get better, there's only one thing to do, and that's throw the toaster out of the window. Mm-hmm. You're going to psychiatry. You're going to the barbershop. That's where you're going. Then they send them to us with already a recommendation of which medicine class they need, by the way. All these psychologists, social workers, and counselors, they're always like, oh yeah, go to a psychiatrist and ask them for an antidepressant. So then they show up with, okay, doc, my therapist told me I need an antidepressant. And we're left right now with that very difficult decision. It's like, wait, hold on, hold the fort. It's a very tough space for me, as you already alluded to. So the undoctor is the doctor who, at least in theory, undiagnoses, unmedicates, and then undoctrinates people. Actually works myself out of a job. That is my interest. I want you to have enough resources that you don't need mental health help anymore ever.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't that be my goal? I think so. I should be like the Maytag guy, you know?
Yeah. Well, an oncologist, eventually you don't want to be going to, if you solve the cancer. You know, I'm a cancer survivor.
Yeah.
I don't see my oncologist every week.
Exactly. Good.
It's like I had cancer in 97. I saw sarcoma at level 3.
That's awesome.
I'm not going to see him every day because he solved it. He's happy. He doesn't need to see me again.
That's awesome. And congratulations. That's so cool to hear. Exactly. That's my intention. And that flies different than my colleagues and the industry as a whole. You know, the industry as a whole is based on month-to-month visits so that you can tell me you're a little bit better or you're about the same in a 7-minute conversation so that I can rewrite your damn script so that you can line up CVS every month and get a prescription, you know, from like a Walgreens or Target or CVS or whatever you get your scripts. That's the purpose of psychiatry, which is just yuck. That's no longer what I wanted to do. Now, with all fairness, last year I started working full time, and I worked as a conventional psychiatrist for an agency. And this agency actually found me on a podcast.
Oh, wow.
Like this. And they came out and got me, and they said, you're our guy. Can you come work for us? And I was like, okay, yeah. And so they have opened the door for me to actually create conversations as a psychiatrist as a way of healing others.
So they were on the same path? They were in the same path? I mean, or maybe not, somewhat same path?
Somewhat the same path. I mean, after all, they have to make money. So I do need to diagnose everybody, and I usually give them whatever low level diagnosis I can, and then create conversations that are healing. And every so often someone shows up at my barbershop. They're like, dude, I've been getting Adderall for, 12 months and I need a new doc and you're my doc. Well, I'm not going to take anybody off of Adderall in that situation. Mm-hmm. I do have the skill set. I do have the license. I can medicate. So that person stays on Adderall. It's rare, and I really appreciate this, that I'm the first guy to diagnose somebody and then give them medicine. You can see that would be unlikely from my perspective. I'm not that happy to do that. Every so often, I've had the challenge where someone comes in and they say, I've never been on medicine, but my sister, my brother, and my best friend think I have attention deficit, or think I have social phobia, or think I have, bipolar disorder. And then they want me to deal with that.
To validate it, yeah.
And so I am left with either dealing with that or losing the patient altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, we can try this medicine, we can try this diagnosis, but let's be honest about what to expect. So I give as much as I can. They call it informed consent, right? My job at that point is to do as much as I can to share what I know about these medicines and what I don't know, and what I know about diagnoses and what I don't know, what it's likely to do and what it's likely not to do. And then, and then they choose to go on medicine or not. If they choose to go on, I go right on, and, I don't have to be embarrassed about prescribing for some people still. So I don't.
You get when they go into a full picture, where maybe somebody else maybe doesn't dive as deep is what you're saying, maybe.
Exactly. That's exactly right. We start looking at, I let people know right away that the real action, the best medicine we have as humans, you already know what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
It's a human connection. It's a human connection. There's nothing that beats that. I'm sorry. You've never had anything that beat that.
It's so interesting that people are so disconnected. The reason I do the podcast in this kind of free format is to have human connections and actually talk to people and not do like a scripted control. That's why I do it live, because I tried to live in this world where people wanted to be too perfect, and they wanted the perfect recorded stop and start, make it, edit it, do all these things.
Right.
And I'm more about like, let's have a real human conversation.
Exactly. With all the bugs and all
whatever
the
ups,
all the stumbles, everything. Yeah.
And it is so hard today because everybody wants to be perfect. And we have all these tools that we can go edit our photo. We can edit our language. We can edit what we write and run it through AI. And is that really you? Or is that the AI? Or is that really you? Or is that the Photoshop? And
right.
So there's so many things where we're not being true. We're not being vulnerable. And I'm kind of a child of the 70s. I'm 56. And I like doing things raw. I like to just record raw without the tools.
Yeah.
Jump on my bass, jump on my piano, and just play it. And if it has a happy accident, it's out of pitch, it's out of tune, that's what it is.
That's what it is. Exactly.
And it's so very hard to get people into that because they were like, can't you go in there and correct it? And I'm like, why would I correct it? That's the beauty of it.
That's what it is. That's the smorgasbord of life, man. I got an A flat that's a little bit out of tune. Oh, well, that's what we got today,
Yeah, it's what it is. It's like a thing like a jazz. It's a kind of thinking in a jazz fusion or bebop or just experimental music standpoint. It's like, why can't I do that? I mean, Lou Reed was famous for not even tuning his guitar.
That's interesting.
He said, why do I need to do that? I'm just going to do it.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that about Lou. That's pretty
He used to like people used to look at him in the studio. Like, well, that's out of tune, Lou. He's like, well, what does that matter to what I'm trying to do?
It's really great. I love that. I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah. So I think we're on the same page here. You start looking at Welcome to Humanity. You start looking at Find Your True Voice. You start looking at, the Creative Eight. And then you start looking at what the Undoctor really is, and you start seeing that they're all together here. It's a transformational restorative coach. And ultimately, I woke up this morning, or maybe it was last night, I don't know, sometime in the last 24 hours. I don't have to release myself from being a doctor. I've done that a lot of times. Like the undoctor actually releases myself from being a doctor. Somehow it almost says I'm not what I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I am. I am
a doctor.
I'm a doctor. I'm a Jewish man. I'm a doctor. All those things are true. There was times that I lived in anti-Semitic neighborhoods and I used to want to downplay my Judaism.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Like Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan, instead of Robert Zimmerman, say you're Bob Dylan, you know.
Exactly. I wanted to do that. And, I don't go to synagogue, or maybe I don't study the Torah, or maybe I don't like celebrate holidays. Then I would tell people that just to somehow wash down what I really am. But if I really want to be honest with myself and with the community, I am a trained 45 years in the field doctor. Mm-hmm. For real. Like, I don't have to be an ex-doctor or like a different doctor or a non-doctor. I don't have to be all that. I can actually own, I am a doctor. I am a psychotherapist. I am a medical physician. I am trained at a premier university. I was a Northwestern University graduate. People get all excited, like, oh, that's a good university, you know. It's like, okay, University of Cincinnati, you know, residency and fellowship. I have like this amazing set of credentials. I look at my CV, I'm blown away. I'm like, who is that dude?
We have the acceptance. Like you were, I guess, like from what you were saying, that you were being disappointed in the role and
right.
kind of divorced from it.
Exactly.
And I've run into people who are like, you know, artists that suddenly decide, well, I don't want to be that.
Right.
And then eventually they accept that, like, well, that's what you can do. That's who,
right.
who that is your style. That is who you are. And then
right.
they try to walk away from it. And then eventually they realize that, like, there's nothing wrong with me being this.
Exactly.
And they have to learn how to kind of rework it in their
exactly.
head after they went through a trauma trying to, you know, reimagine themselves. It's like, well, you know, not that you can't grow, but that is who you are as a human being.
Exactly. It's just who I am as a human being. And it's a pretty cruel, it's a pretty cool credential after all. And people really like, you know, like they think highly of doctors. People, you know, I can have a pretty large space in the community, and I really am. I'm really an MD. I'm really a licensed MD. I'm really a board certified MD. I'm really an MD with over 30,000 patients in my past. And I've been doing this stuff, like, no kidding, full time or double time every single day for as long as you, almost not you, I suppose, but because you're sitting up there in your 50s. But, you know, for the people 40 years old, as long as they've been alive, you know, I've been right here.
Well, I think what's interesting is, like, you know, when you have that acceptance and you learn how to navigate, you know, your humanity, you know, it's a hard thing. Well, how can you not do that? But a lot of people are trying to, you know, hide. They hide
exactly.
so much, and they don't know. They got the imposter syndrome. Everybody talks about it, but it's like they don't feel good in their own skin. Right?
Exactly.
They don't, and how do you get out of that other than accepting there's a certain level of discomfort?
Exactly.
Right? No matter what I've ever dealt with. And I remember, like, I always mention this, like, David Bowie is a great artist, but he used to say, I didn't feel good as an artist unless I was treading water. And, you know, I would go and do things that are beyond my capability.
Yeah.
In order to push myself, because I didn't feel comfortable with just phoning it in.
Yeah.
So I would go push myself, you know, hang out with Luther Vandross and know he can sing better than me.
Yeah.
Hang out with Stevie Ray Vaughan knowing he can play guitar better than me.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So that's a hard thing for some people.
Yeah.
They can't put themselves next to somebody else that they know is better than them.
Yeah. Yeah. Bowie was really great like that. And, you know, in all of his career, he's one of my favorites as well. And, you know, you start looking at all the places where he was on the edge. And for David Bowie to call himself a musician would be just almost a deep understatement of who that man really was. And,
yeah.
you know, he was David Bowie after all. He ended up being nothing more or less than David Bowie. And it's who he is.
Like a Renaissance person. Like he's just like, he's like, oh, you know, he had theater. He had, you know, he could play sax, but he would hide from it. You know, he could do it, but play guitar. But he's like, you know, he was a showman.
He's a
he
true
was a creative person. He's a creative dynamo, actor. And he learned how to bring theater into music.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think his thing is like the being in that theater and realizing that, I can go and shape and become like a method actor.
Yeah.
As a musician and do that on stage and be in Ziggy and stay Ziggy, which maybe is not good for you, but, you know, he would stay as Ziggy in character for the whole tour.
He knew a way. He knew a way to step away too. He knew how to be a family man. He knew how to be in a relationship. He knew how to take care of himself. You know, he seemed to be living in multiple different directions at the same time. But that's only from my perspective. He was just another human being. Most people think, although some people might suggest that Bowie was from another planet. But
it's just when you find that you can. You know, I guess it be very expansive. I've always been, you know, when I look at guys like Bowie or Miles Davis or, you know, Prince and Hendrix, the thing I like is the expansive nature of their art.
Yeah.
When you look at the great artists, like you mentioned, a lot of the painters, is like the expansive nature of challenging yourself.
Exactly.
And taking pain and learning how to use it.
Right. Well, you know, you're looking, you already mentioned a bunch of people on the edges inside music. I mentioned the visual artists, but you've, you know, if you look at Miles or you look at Hendrix or you look at Bowie or look at Lou Reed, you know, look, some of these players who just were Prince, like you said, you know, they're on the boundaries of what is expected inside. They can do the conventional plenty good, plenty good. Mm-hmm. These are fundamentally extremely sound musicians. Everyone you just named, totally sound. And then they were allowed to vary on the themes. They allowed themselves to go way out there and then way beyond and then actually create sounds and patterns that nobody before them had ever done. They were allowed to actually create.
Push the envelope, yeah. It's hard to do that because a lot of times you get the bell curve. Like when I'm at work, I'm in software design. And like a lot of times the business I'm in, they're always looking for the guys that are going to be like the new Steve Jobs. But they build a cubicle in a box structure. Like these guys are like artists. They're like Rembrandts. They're like Renaissance people. They don't want to be in the cube.
Yeah.
Right. So if you want somebody who's going to be a Renaissance person, don't put them in the cube.
Exactly.
But then they say, well, why can't we put them in the cube? It's like, well, that's not, you're not going to get them.
Yeah. You're not going to grow. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Salvador was not in a cube. I promise. He knew about the complexity of what it means to be in a cube. And that showed up in his art. Like he knew about what we're talking about, the interface or the intricate, you know, discomfort, if you will, or the capacity. Like he did a lot of cube, like just speaking directly to the cube, like, you know, the restriction and the prisons that we create for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can be in your own prison. I mean, a lot of times you can, like artists can be like stuck in a lane and then they break out of it. Right.
Yeah.
And but then it's like, you know, it's like their one number one song is like, they're stuck in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you create that like one hit wonder.
Yeah.
You can do more than that. And a lot of times you are more than that, but the world only sees you as that.
Yeah, you know, and you're, again, looking at the rock stars, you can look at Stairway to Heaven, or you can look at, you know, Satisfaction, or you can look at, I don't know, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And at some point, these guys had to lay those songs down and then grow after that, you know, like
go beyond it. Yeah,
the Beatles had to do that.
Yeah, they were the ultimate, like, teeny bopper band that became, like, experimental band. You know, mm-hmm. you look at the White Album, Abbey Road, is like, that's not what they were doing with Help.
That's not what they were doing
early.
That's
right. It's like their guy, the studio became a canvas.
Exactly. And it
was like George Martin would always talk about, like, we can treat the studio like an expressionist painter treats the canvas. We can layer. And we talk about sound paintings.
Yeah.
And George Martin brought the idea, like, you can use the studio and layer like paint.
Yeah.
And that's what brought the modern music era and the album structure, and you get the Pink Floyds of the world and all those other things, because they started to realize you could do more than what you could actually play live.
Yeah, exactly.
You can actually layer and do expressive experimental things that you can't do live.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Steve, that became
a whole example of that too.
World.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. And you know, that's so many people want to just say, oh, I just want the formula, but they can do so much more than the formula.
Yeah. You're fighting a very similar battle out there in the world. I think there's a lot of, resonance between what's happening inside of your mind and who you are. Speaking about the interface between, like, you know, AI and humanity, or the interface between conventional music and revolutionary music, because the people you name, including Pink Floyd and all of them, they all pushed out music that had never been heard before, using the foreground of conventional competence, completely conventionally competent, all of them. Completely. Yeah. And therefore given the license to explode past the major barriers and go out there and actually explore. And that's the people that you've named. And I think that's what we're talking about with Welcome to Humanity too. It's like, get it. It's uncomfortable, dude. It's uncomfortable.
That's a hard thing.
It's uncomfortable being human.
And people want it to be easier.
Well,
and I think that's a big, big problem. It's like everybody wants it to be easier. And it's like, if you ever ask any of the great people you admire, right, they had like 10,000 hours worth of practice.
Exactly.
Right. It didn't just automatically happen.
Exactly.
Happened for all these people. The muscle memory. It's the, you know, an actor memory of how many, how much work did they do before you saw them?
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
And they just think it happens overnight, and nothing happens overnight.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you talk to even to the writers, even to multiple writers, even like Orwell or Huxley, or if you could step up to Stephen King or whatever, you know, whatever writers are your favorite, the ones who are the science fiction writers
Isaac Asimov,
Robert Heinlein, you start really looking at these folks and they're like, they worked. These were not comfortable dudes. These were not people who were like totally enjoy all day. That's what I'm saying about Prozac. Prozac, by being on the cover of Newsweek and Time in 87, became sort of this emblem, like, we can fix your discomfort. We can be your elixir. We can be your panacea. There is a pill out there that will decrease your discomfort or eliminate it. In fact, there was major talk during those years, 87, 88, 89, about dumping that shit into the water system in Los Angeles and New York.
Wow, like fluoride? Just put it in there.
Just put it right in there.
Oh, geez.
But to
get rid of all the creativity. Like being an artist is like, you know, angst and feelings is like part of art, you know. And as a songwriter, and like, if I didn't feel and I didn't figure out a way to take my feelings and express, I couldn't play my piano.
Exactly.
I couldn't play my bass guitar.
What would happen if we were to smother Jimi Hendrix?
His manic depression, he kind of talked about it. Like, he knew he had it.
Manic depression,
He knew it. He talked about it. He voiced it. People who saw him felt it, like he probably did have it.
From the descriptions. If there is an it, he had it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, that is it, you know, the impetus of like all art, you know, Coltrane, and all the great artists. It's like, you feel something and then you express it. It's the art therapy. It's how you actually work through.
I think, when you speak to what you're saying, and I'm just going through the whole lyrics of Manic Depression while you're talking, you know, it's I know what I want, but I just don't know. Music, sweet music, flip from my fingers. Manic Depression is a full straight in mess, you know. And it's like, you know, he knew there was something here, but he also knew that he didn't. He also knew he was just freaking human. Yeah. He's just Jimi Hendrix. That's all. He's just that guy who pounds away music, sweet music. You know, like that's what he is. And that he was translating that extreme amount of life experience directly through those six strings. Pretty remarkable.
And that's just how, you know, I think
Miles
people...
too. Miles too. Miles too.
He would just destroy genres. He'd be in the canon and say, well, I don't care about being the bebop god.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I'm going to be into fusion.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do. It's like, I'm going to change it. And and then people say, well, you know, like Dylan, they yelled and said he was the Judas when he went electric.
Exactly.
And what I love what he said is like, I don't believe you. If you listen to the tape, when they started rebelling because he went electric, he kept on playing electric. And he said, you know, they yelled and they said, you're a Judas. It's like, I don't believe you.
I know, right.
And he just kept on going. And I'm like, well, that's how you keep on going. Like, you have to
persevere. There's a courage involved, and it's a funky kind of courage. They call it courage when you choose to be yourself, rather than cowardly when you choose to be somebody else to protect yourself. Because the truth is, we all know what it's like to pretend to be someone we're not in order to protect the person that we are. We all know what it's like. We were taught how to do that as a student. By first grade, you were doing that every day.
Yeah.
Then we have to. And then if the crack in the cement gets larger and larger, you never go back to fix it. And now you know how to pretend to be somebody else that you're not in order to so-called protect the person that you are. But the courageous souls that we're talking about, we could go and certainly into the athletic realm too and find all sorts of superstars in the various sports that did the same thing. You know, we could talk about Kobe, you talk about LeBron, talk about Michael. You know, we could go into that sport and play hard into these freelancers. Even the present players, you know, Luka and Jokic and Victor, you start looking at guys who are still pressing the edges of what it means.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who are most interesting because they're courageously going after this game the way they can go at it. They're still being, you know,
themselves. You can be creative. That's the creative, you know, is like you don't have to clone. What I always tell people, like, don't be scared of who you are, right?
Exactly.
Go in and don't show me, like, I run into
a doctor. I'm a doctor. You know, Tim Duncan can say, I am a basketball player. But the truth is, so can Zion Williamson. So can Jokic. So can Victor. So can Giannis. They can all, I am a basketball player. They're all basketball players. They just do it differently. And it's fine. It's like super cool to be creative. That's where success really comes in. When you can be aligned with who your core value is, find your true voice for real. Welcome to humanity. For real. Find your true voice and Welcome to Humanity are my two brands. That's what I'm all about. It's what I've been about. Thank you for letting me even speak to that today. Because this is the truth, dude. I don't have anything better than this.
Yeah, I want to remind people, we do have your link, drfred360.com. So like, if people click on that, what do they find there? Is that how they can book to talk to you?
Yeah, there's a discovery option there. You can definitely both, you know, we can talk a little bit about how I can help you or whatever your corporation needs. I do corporate consulting as well, or what going on with someone you know or yourself. We can talk about whether there's a good fit. And if there isn't, I have enough friends that I can send you in whatever direction. Then you get copies of my books. They're, you know, the PDFs are on that as well. And you can get me to send you a copy of my hardcover of Find Your True Voice or my courses. I've created a couple courses or places I am on social media, LinkedIn for Facebook. There's entryways. That's a pretty cool site.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a whole lot about what I'm up to and what I've been doing. Stuff I'm doing in AI and mental health.
That's awesome. Yeah, we didn't get to talk about that as much because we're kind of at the end. But I do appreciate that you took the time to talk to us today on the Family Electric Coach podcast. And we do encourage people to click that link because it will be clickable. We were just on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. We'll be on all the other major podcast platforms where you can listen to or watch podcasts later today. And thank you again for being on the Family Electric Coach podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Great questions, great conversation. Totally appreciate what you're up to. Thank you so much for having me as an honored guest for your show. Peace.
Thank you. Have a good day.